Hey, this is Zenu, and you're listening to Anti-Moon Boy News. We got a big episode for you guys today. We're going to be going over the SEC roundtable that happened yesterday, which had to do with financial privacy and cryptocurrency. There were a lot of presenters, and shockingly, at least the second half of it was very good. So we're going to be going over that. But first, we got to get to the big breaking news that also happened yesterday. And that is Donald Trump saying during a press conference that he is going to consider a pardon of Keone Rodriguez. Let's listen into the clip.
Mr. President, this week a man named Keone Rodriguez is going to federal prison for creating crypto privacy software. The case was started under the Biden administration, but your DOJ kept it going and secured the conviction. A lot of people in crypto are saying that this man should be pardoned. Are you familiar with the case at all, or would you be interested?
I've heard about it. I'll look at it. Why, you think he should be pardoned? Sounds like, based on your question.
Many people in the
Rodriguez, we'll look at that, Pam. Okay, let's take a look at it. You know, you'll have to tell me. I don't know anything about it, but we'll take a look.
Boom. So there it is. Trump actually saying the name of the Samurai developer, Keone Rodriguez, and saying he's aware of the case. I kind of doubt that, but he motioned to Pam Bondi, the attorney general, said, we need to look into this. We'll get back to you on this. You know, it's not a for sure thing, but man, that's a white pill. You know what I mean? That is a white pill, because up until this point, it has been pretty grim. It's been a rough year. I think I said that exact quote like one or two episodes ago, that it's been a rough year for crypto privacy. Like, it's been rough. This would flip the script and turn this, you know, rough year into, like, actually we made some progress. Amazingly. Because throwing out this case against Samurai Wallet and by pardoning these developers, it would signify that maybe we actually can make some progress on the privacy front. Now, I know what you're thinking. I got some skeptics out there who think this is just Trump, you know, appeasing his donators, you know, the Bitcoin guys out there. And yeah, it is. I'm not going to lie. But you know what? We got to take our wins when we can get them, okay? We got to. And we can build off this, is the thing. Because if this administration is willing to work with us on pardoning Keone, then why not Tornado Cash as well? And from there, we can actually, like, work towards having something that isn't invasive when it comes to, you know, developers building privacy tools. Because obviously, the Samurai Wallet case, the Tornado Cash case, it's beyond just cryptocurrency. This impacts, like, all software. And it's a very slippery slope. So this is a big win. I don't know if it's going to happen, huffing on the hopium, but it seems like the odds are probably pretty decent now. Now, the question was actually asked by a journalist by the name of Sander Lutz from Decrypt Media. He asked another question as well, unrelated to this. And, I mean, I give this guy a lot of credit. He framed the question perfectly, you know, saying that they were arrested under the Biden administration, right? And, you know, why is the Trump administration continuing this? Because they're going after Bitcoin developers. And, you know, great question. And Trump's like, yeah, let's look into it. Honestly, he probably has no idea, right? And I doubt, like, the way government works, you just got to have the highest bidder in your ear. And that kind of gets the show going, right? It kind of gets people working for you, essentially. And I think that's what happened here. There was probably a couple Bitcoin donors who were like, hey, Trump, come on. Or they planted this journalist there and they gave him the okay to ask the question. And he did. So fingers crossed. We're going to be, you know, checking Twitter every hour probably for the next couple days. Because the thing is, on I think it's this Friday, Keone has to go to report for prison. So hopefully he can get out before then. But even then, like, now there's a chance that a pardon can happen, you know, even a couple months from now or something, right? So it's just starting the ball rolling, and who knows, right? Who knows what can happen with this? But it kind of just goes to show you that even though a lot of this, you know, retweeting and raising awareness may seem silly to some people, it actually ended up working out in the end, because the raising awareness got to people who were in the ear of the president, and now it's in the president's ear, and the president has a thing for pleasing people. he's a bit of a schmoozer. So I don't know. It's been a rough year for crypto in general, the stable coins, and up until this point, the attacks on financial privacy. But this would be a huge reversal for the Trump administration, and I'd be so pumped if it does happen. Because really what it is it's signifying a switch into the actual privacy season. You know, for the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about the cringy privacy season people are talking about, which is, you know, just Moonboy BS masquerading as privacy season. But like the freedom of one of the core, you know, cypherpunks in the Bitcoin community from incarceration. Now that's privacy season. That's a huge deal, and it's going to be kind of just a rallying day of happiness if it does happen. If right. So our fingers are crossed. You know, all we can do now is wait. I'm shocked, though, this actually happened. That was that was one of the crazier, videos that popped up on my Twitter feed that I can remember. But it's why you play the game, right? It's why you, even though this whole politics stuff sucks, and I hate it, I hate the state, you gotta at least try. It's worth it to at least try, because if you do nothing, if you stand still and do nothing, they're just gonna take even more. And you can't let that happen. Because, you know, so in addition to this, you know, I also saw with the SEC roundtable discussion that we're about to get into, a lot of just negativity overall towards this panel for even happening, right? Which is completely understandable for what it's worth, because I don't like the state. So, like, you know, I'm in agreement. But there's also this, like mentality amongst some of these people where it's, like, very nihilistic. It's like, don't even interact with the state at all. And while I agree that, like, backroom deals, those are bad, I don't like lobbying, I don't like, you know, things like that, it's still good to get to a situation where you can make things better for everybody, all else equal. Because, like, we take a lot of liberties with how we use encryption today that weren't just given to us. You know, we had to win those, or at least we had to win them back, because the state was trying to encroach on them. And you can look up those cases, but, you know, code is free speech, and that's a big deal. So let's now pivot to this SEC roundtable on financial surveillance and privacy. And so going into this, the three things I really wanted to get out of this, right? The first and the main thing is, if you're talking about financial privacy and surveillance, it would be absolutely insane if you're not also going to talk about the developers who are being thrown in jail for making tools for financial privacy and to prevent surveillance. So I was really hoping that we'd hear people actually mentioning Samurai Wallet and Tornado Cash, and Bitcoin Fog, for that matter. So that was the first thing, and spoiler, it did happen. So that was pretty cool. Now, the second thing is I wanted to hear discussions about the encroachment on self-custody in, for example, in Europe, where that's kind of what's happening over time, right? They're trying to limit the sizes of transactions that can be sent. They're trying to get rid of self-custody altogether, things like that. That didn't happen. And the last thing, Monero, right? Obviously, we love Monero on this channel. That also did not happen. They did not say Monero a single time, which isn't really that surprising. Whenever they would talk about cryptocurrencies, they would just say Bitcoin as kind of the placeholder for all cryptocurrencies. Going into this, though, what I'm expecting, though, is like every other, you know, hearing that I've heard for cryptocurrency from Capitol Hill. The United States government, you know, once or twice a year has some sort of hearing that they show on C-SPAN, and I always watch it, and it always sucks, okay? It's always like you have like seven or so people from the cryptocurrency industry that are like very influential people. So like the guy from Coinbase, you know, the guy from Kraken. You'll have like different people like that, and you'll have them in front of various, you know, United States politicians who will ask them questions. And so the way the format ends up playing out is, you know, the Democrats will ask questions all about like, or only about like diversity or like climate change, you know, things like that. And Republicans will ask questions about like terrorism, you know. But even though they both play their bases, every so often you'll get like a nice question thrown in there by someone who like actually knows what they're talking about. And so then you get something out of it at least. So that's kind of what I was expecting going into this. And that's not at all what we got. There were really two halves of this presentation. Actually, literally there were. The first half was essentially a panel, but they really were just different people who gave presentations. And this was really clownish and chilly, and it was a total waste of time. The second half, though, was this panel of experts in policy, and it was really good. So the first half, we're going to kind of just make fun of, and then when we get to the second half, we will kind of break it down in a little more detail. The event began with some opening remarks from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And I actually missed this part. I tuned in at around 1:40 or so. But I did hear that there were some positive things that were said during this. And fortunately, there were some transcripts that were uploaded of the speeches that were given by one Paul S. Atkins, as well as Hester M. Pierce. I'm not going to read their whole entire speech. I'd be sitting here for like 10 minutes. But the interesting part of what Paul Atkins said, and I'm going to read this little paragraph here, is he says that, quote, "Public blockchains are more transparent than any legacy financial system ever built. Every movement of value is recorded on a ledger that anyone can inspect. Chain analytics firms are already exceptional at assisting law enforcement with linking on-chain activity to off-chain identities. In other words, pushed in the wrong direction, crypto could become the most powerful financial surveillance architecture ever invented." End quote. Kind of funny that feds are saying this, but he's right. And the gist of what he's saying is that this is new technology and it's great, but the lack of privacy is a problem. And this would be a recurring motif throughout this entire event, really, is that Bitcoin is not encrypted. That was what they were using. They were using the Zcash encrypted Bitcoin motto. Because if I didn't mention that, by the way, half the people there were like related to Zcash, and you know, we'll get to that in a sec. Okay, maybe not half. It was, but there were a couple people. You know, I think overall the main thing that we're seeing here is we have entered this new paradigm now, where like people have now figured out that Bitcoin is not private. And even Bitcoiners will basically just like admit this, or they'll, you know, the hardcore Bitcoiners will be like, you know, well, I use, you know, X, Y, and Z or whatever. And it's like, okay, you do you. But like the general public understands that Bitcoin is not private anymore. Maybe not the general public, but like the cryptocurrency person, like in general, like the average cryptocurrency user, I think at this point they understand that. Even if you are a hardcore Bitcoin maximalist and you think you can, you know, use Bitcoin privately, which I would argue you actually can. For the average person, the average normie, they're not using Bitcoin privately. And why do we know that? Because of darknet markets, stupid. Right? Those are the normies using privacy, darknet markets. That is what why we study them, right? But I think that though, that is that darknet market usage though, that's a reflection of just how regular people are viewing Bitcoin in a privacy context. It's not viewed as digital cash anymore. Instead, it's used as a tech stock. That's how it's viewed, right? So that was the one of the remarks. Another one, quote, deep thought about financial surveillance and privacy issues as they relate to cryptocurrencies is not new. Some of our panelists and others like Ian Myers and Matthew Green, a side note, those are two Zcash researchers, have been thinking about these issues for many years, but new technological developments are broadening the conversation. Accordingly, the recently passed Genius Act, which regulates centralized stablecoins, directs Treasury to identify, innovate, or novel methods, techniques, or strategies that regulated financial institutions use or have the potential to use to detect illicit activities such as money laundering involving digital assets. That process is underway. Also in process are efforts to develop tools to enable law-abiding citizens to live private lives and protect themselves from bad actors. Zero-knowledge proofs shield private information while proving, for example, that someone is permitted to conduct a given transaction. Mixers enable people to make charitable donations, get paid, lend money to a friend, or engage in other legal transactions without telegraphing them to the world. Decentralized physical infrastructure networks provide essential services without a central actor who can withhold these services from disfavored people. At today's roundtable, we will hear about these and other new technologies designed to protect the privacy of transactions occurring on blockchains to streamline compliance. The SEC does not endorse any particular product, but understanding how these technologies work will inform policymakers as they seek to address the threats facing this nation without undermining our civil liberties. End quote. That was from the Commissioner Hester M. Pierce. Now, that's not a bad statement overall. I know they have to put in the whole compliance thing. Obviously, it's the SEC talking. They want to streamline compliance. But he's literally talking about, you know, zero knowledge proofs. He mentions mixers. I think that's code for Monero, right? Mixers enable people to make charitable donations, get paid, lend money to a friend, or engage in legal transactions without telegraphing them to the world. That right there is a great statement. That's perfect. That's exactly what we're saying, you know, with Monero and stuff. So it's like they understand these things. And then, of course, you know, they mention, you know, we want to hear about these new technologies to protect privacy, and we want to streamline compliance. And it's like, okay, what does that mean? And that's kind of the question mark here. But it seems like they're at least open to the discussion. And as we're going to see later on, there is a lot of good discussion happening. All right, so we get to the panel, and the first individual was a lady named Jill Gunter. And so, yeah, the first half of this, which we're going to do the first half now, was like people who would basically just go and do a presentation for a product or something. And then they had a Q&A at the end, which we'll get to later on. Now, I actually missed Jill's presentation because I arrived like at the very end of it. But I caught the best part. evidently. And basically what she says is that, you know, she takes this very, you know, privacy very seriously and stuff and protecting people because last week she was hacked. Yeah, that's right. This expert that they have on the panel was hacked for $30,000 last week. She clicked a bad link or something and her Ethereum wallet was drained. I'm not making this up. You can read about it, right? So this is from Protos. Jill Gunter has wallet drained via vulnerable third web contract. On Thursday, Jill Gunter, co-founder of the base layer for Rollups Espresso, took to X to inform followers her wallet had been drained, which we eventually learned was due to a vulnerability in a third web contract. The 10-year crypto veteran noted the deep irony of her funds being funneled into privacy protocol Railgun while she was writing a defense of privacy in crypto to present DC next week. The thing is, she then goes on to say during the presentation, I wrote this down, that it was unfortunate because they weren't able to halt the transaction with buffers and safeguards. That's what she said. Yeah, so we're already off to a bad start because here you have this lady who's this 10-year crypto veteran who had her wallet drained. Yeah, and you know, she's saying that it's better, it would be better if we had these safeguards and regulations for average people. And to her point, she is kind of right. Like, the normal person is not using cryptocurrency because it's confusing and they'll get hacked. Because here you have this expert who got hacked, right? So this kind of, yeah, this does fall in line with my general belief in crypto that most people are not using it. They're kind of just holding it as tech stocks. And I don't really see that changing anytime soon, really. You know, if you're going to funnel people into these, you know, centralized applications that are have the ability to, you know, stop funds and freeze funds and return funds and stuff, kind of defeats the purpose of, you know, decentralized, centralist transactions, does it not? You know? So we got off to a rough start there with Jill. And then we had Zuko. Good old Zuko looking like a dork on stage. Everyone's like wearing suits and he's wearing some like plaid shirt with jeans or whatever. Although, to be honest, can you actually imagine Zuko wearing a suit? I can't either. So I think he probably, his handlers, they dressed him well, right? So yeah, Zuko, I mean, the guy's, he's a bit of a goofball. I don't know if you've ever, you know, heard him talk. He's kind of whimsical. I don't know how to describe him, really. He like opened up talking about his mom wrote a message for them. I don't know if this was a joke or it wasn't. It was kind of weird. I don't know. Anyway, he said like a couple good things. You know, he says he received a subpoena from the SEC, which made him very angry, but now he's there and he's grateful. He says a couple things that are I don't disagree with about, you know, cryptocurrency and what it gives you. And then he spends, honest to God, like 4 minutes talking about how to download the Zashi wallet. Like, it goes on like a long time. And like, you're spending 4 minutes, you know, okay, now go to this website and download with the QR code. And, you know, very weird. So, yeah, that wasn't good at all. Next up, we have Aleo. And Aleo is this, you know, this other competitor of Ethereum. And they have like this chart during their presentation, and it's like Bitcoin is to Ethereum what Zcash is to Aleo, you know. And it's he says the phrase encrypted Bitcoin like 5 times. He mentions that Zcash researchers Ian Myers and Matthew Green were in attendance working with Aleo, and that's true. Aleo is, I looked them up. They are a venture capitalist funded smart contract. Kind of, or layer one smart contract platform with like zero knowledge proofs with staking. Yeah, it's basically what you would expect from, you know, a Zcash adjacent company. So one thing that was interesting here was he talked about American ideals and how this needs to be U.S. centric, and that if we miss out on this opportunity to build this these things, businesses will move offshore and we will miss out on Web 3. And I had this like light bulb moment at this point, because I realized that that's actually a lot of the subtext of like a lot of these presentations is they're pitching this for America, which I know it sounds dumb that I'm like realizing this now, but like I always interpret cryptocurrency as like a global decentralized thing, but here they're pitching it as American companies, like made in America crypto, which is weird, right? Like it, cause it's such a global decentralized thing, but like that made me realize like, oh, and so for the rest of, you know, these talks, I kind of had that in the back of my mind of like, oh, this is what they're doing, right? They're pitching this. And it's kind of this relationship where they lobby Trump, and in return, they get all these tax breaks and, you know, regulations that favor them, et cetera. And that's really what's been happening. Next up, we had this guy named Simone. I honestly had a hard time following along, because I was already like, at this point, I was already like, I was getting kind of annoyed and grumpy. Grumpy Xenu, dude, it's hard for me, like, because I'm like realizing I have another 2 hours of this shit, right? And I'm thinking of that. And yeah, this guy, he had a very thick French accent. Now next up, oh yeah, so this one was called Predicate, which is programmable policy enforcement. Predicate is a blockchain technology company that simplifies transaction prerequisites by enabling users, developers, and communities to define and enforce rules for on-chain interactions. Their platform integrates expressive pre-transaction logic into decentralized applications, enhancing security and compliance in the blockchain ecosystem. Horrible, right? Anyways, they were mostly talking about like tokenized securities. They weren't really talking about like digital cash, at least. You know, to a point, like, it's true that if we're going to have like Wall Street adopt like crypto and have like tokenized stuff, they're going to want to have like regulations like totally built in. So I can see how this would actually be used. But yeah, man, like this type of technology is just like creepy to me. And by the way, they're working with Aleo, or I think it's like a part of Aleo or something like that, which is associated with Zcash. The next up, oh God, this is even worse. Spruce ID. And Spruce ID is talking about digital ID. They're a digital ID company, and they want to create user-controlled digital identity, which is what data can a company access, only the data that the user selects to disclose. And I guess they had a pilot program for the California DMV. And he mentioned this, and this was kind of a throwaway line, but I think this is actually really, really important to highlight. He said that community college students were given benefits streamlined through the mobile ID. So they had this, like, the digital ID was, like, on your phone, and you would, like, present it when you were, like, signing in or whatever. And what he's saying here is, like, they would have, like, benefits from the college. It was supplied directly through the digital ID. And that right there, folks, this is how digital ID is going to be pitched to people. This is, they're going to get their benefits, their welfare, what have you. It's all going to be through digital ID. That's how it's going to work. It's very simple. So what this guy is saying, he says the word streamline like fucking, like at least a dozen times. He's talking about how much easier it is, blah, blah, blah. And there's a truth to that where it does like, it forces things into one centralized form of identification, but there's a lot of problems that come with that, right? Because once you centralize everything and everybody into like one identification, then you can build off of it, right? Then you can streamline stuff, and then you can withhold some stuff, and then you start to get into bad territory. And as it is, we're already dealing with things like that, and to have your ID dependent on it, yeah, that would not be cool. To be fair, though, there is issues with fraud. And so he argues that this would help with that. I'm not necessarily sure if that's right or not. I think fraud's going to be an issue regardless. So that was the last guy. Then they went to a Q&A after that. And the first question from the Q&A was about... you can listen to this. This was a Zcash planted question. You fucking listen to this question, okay? But anyways, the lady basically asked how Zcash would deal with regulations, which was actually a good question. And Zuko actually gave a kind of a decent answer. He kind of avoided the question, though. So let's actually listen into this.
There we go.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bose-Hayes, formerly of FinCEN, and my question is for Zuko. I was just wondering if you could speak to Zcash's efforts to meet regulatory obligations like the travel rule around things like messaging fields or shielded transactions or viewing keys or things like that, and whether you think maybe there's an opportunity for regulators to actually ask more of developers around, you know, privacy-enhancing technologies via regulation, if there's an opportunity there, and whether you think your efforts have been a success. Thank you.
Turn it on.
Okay, how about now? That was a big question. I'll try to answer one part, at least. You asked, can regulators ask developers to do more? And I really like that question because I'm a developer who's written a lot of software and like uploaded it to the internet. But nowadays, Zcash isn't under the control of the developers anymore. It's under the control of the users. It's like Bitcoin, you know, like you could ask a Bitcoin developer to write some Bitcoin code that would do something different with Bitcoin. Maybe it would raise the 21 million cap to 22 million. You could probably get a developer to do that, especially if you paid him, or if you're a regulator and you asked him to do it and he chose to comply. But you can't get the Bitcoin users to run that code. And so it is with Zcash. I can write whatever code I want, but I can't get the Zcash users to run it. I don't know if that helps, but that's my honest answer to that part of your question.
Yeah, so that was an interesting way to avoid the question, but also answer it, I guess, because what he's saying is that, you know, we could write all this different code, but because this is a decentralized network, users don't have to be obligated to run that code. But does that mean the Zcash core team would write that code and it would require other people to fork away from Zcash? You know what I mean? So I'm not really sure what he means by that. It's kind of a way to not like completely avoid the question. And he didn't give any specifics, of course. All right, so now we're in the second half of this roundtable. And like I said, the second half just had a lot more substance. I'm mostly going to be playing clips of J.W. Verrett and Jay Stanley, the ACLU guy, because they did great. So I'm going to just play a clip, react to it, play another clip, react to it. You get the idea. But yeah, the format of this was much more loose. It was kind of like a conversation a bunch of people were having at a table. It was actually pretty cool because it was like very, yeah, it was very engaging. Like, and it seemed kind of like natural, which was, you know, a lot different than these hearings that happen. And it was also worth noting too because there was no politicians there. They were all just members of different companies and all that, and. You know, because of that, it seemed like they weren't shilling things necessarily, or they weren't, responding like under oath or anything. So because of that, it made for a better conversation. And furthermore, they all don't like AML KYC. So they're all in agreement about that. And that's something that's great to hear because, you know, AML KYC right now is awful. And they say a lot of good things about what they want to fix with it, or at least what they want to prevent. So first off, we're going to hear from J.W. Verrett, this clip here, which I thought was a really great opening statement from him.
Thank you. And I like that you started out by explaining that there's a need, the tech is here, and there's a need for a framework. And what I'd like to do actually through this discussion is for us to get towards baby steps. What are the practical baby steps? And I think you've sort of started us out in order to address this tension between privacy and security. What are the things that need to happen? And I'll turn to J.W. Verrett. I've heard you argue that there is a perimeter beyond, and I think I'm quoting you, but maybe I'm paraphrasing, that there's a perimeter beyond which governmental financial surveillance has no constitutional grounding, which you say is non-custodial DeFi. What, according to you, is within this perimeter? And explain precisely what lies outside that perimeter.
Sure. So historically at the SEC has looked to the guidance of Treasury Department in implementation of AML KYC obligations for regulated parties. This is pretty easy to do when assets trade in an environment that's fully regulated. Everyone it touches is regulated, the exchanges, the brokers, the dealers. What happens when tokenized equity lives in DeFi, which is something I hope we'll see next year? I would argue I have a hard time finding the SEC's jurisdiction for AML KYC regulation of tokenized equity living in that environment. I don't see it in the federal securities laws. They all reference the intermediary party, the broker-dealer. And as a pragmatic matter, even if you could change it, I'm here to urge the SEC to reconsider looking to the guidance and leadership of FinCEN and OFAC. I mean, the fact is, in the last few years, Treasury's record in defending expansion of AML KYC is not great. It's about 0-4. Corporate Transparency Act, 0-3 across multiple jurisdictions. Big loss in its aggressive designation of tornado cash. So 0-4, this is a record that a New York Giants fan can actually talk trash to, right? So I don't think it's a good idea for the SEC to look to the guidance of the Treasury Department in considering what KYC AML obligations to attach to tokenized equity living in DeFi. It's not a good idea. I also don't see the statutory basis for it. And if you want to talk bigger discussion about the founders and about constitutional law, I would recommend reading Justice Thomas's concurrence in a case called McIntyre, where he reviews the history of the founders' understanding of privacy as anonymity. Boy, they were privacy maxis and anonymity maxis like me, partly because their favorite hobby was lighting each other up in the press and anonymously. And efforts to de-anonymize them were fought back, successfully fought back. I would define that perimeter as tokenized equity trading in true DeFi.
Yeah, this is a really sharp answer because not only does he list all these different, you know, cases and, you know, these writings and stuff, he clearly knows what he's talking about, but he also mentions Tornado Cash directly by name. And that was the first time Tornado Cash was mentioned this entire time. He mentions how their record for, you know, protecting the rights of people has been abysmal so far, and he's, you know, urging them to reconsider and things like that. So great start, and let's move on. All right, so next up we're going to hear from Jay, the ACLU analyst, and he gives a great response here. Let's check it out.
And I think that I think we're doing that. I think each of you has shown that, you know, we're looking at this as, I think many of us are seeing privacy as a part of everything, right? There's not just one, oh, that's privacy, and it's a static thing, you have it. It's what is the policy? What is the policy objective? And then how do we maintain and preserve privacy based on our laws? I want to round up our opening discussion. I want to come to you, Jay Stanley. You've been researching, writing, and speaking on emerging tech at the ACLU for over 20 years. And I heard you say once that we've got all this crypto magic. We should use it. What did you mean?
Yeah, what I meant there was cryptography. And I mean the technologies that we've been talking about in terms of zero-knowledge proofs and the like. And that I think that there is a lag between what is available in that technology. Some of that technology is 20, 30 years old, and some of it is brand new. Some of it is old, but it hasn't been figured out how to be implemented and so forth. But there are increasing opportunities for us to have our cake and eat it too, in terms of being able to preserve our privacy while achieving other goals. And so, for example, in the digital identity realm, we are gravely concerned by the digital identity systems, the digital driver's license systems that are being passed in the states, which are not being done with sufficient protections for civil liberties, especially the protections against the fact that we're going to wake up one day, and because it's so easy to share your ID, that every website you go to is going to demand that you click here to share a digital driver's license. The fact that you can go to a bar and that you can just prove your prove that you're over 21 without proving your age or your birth date. But what if the bar is like, no, I want everything on your driver's license. Oh, so your friends are in there? You want to join them? Sorry, you're going to have to do it all. There's real world power that will that digital identity will fall into making, could actually worsen people's privacy because it's so easy to, sites are not going to ask you to like do a 3D video and hold up your thing unless they really need to because it's a big ask. But if it's just click here, they're going to ask. And so it could actually be a detriment to privacy. And more broadly, I mean, it could be used in payments as well, these technologies. They could be used in other areas. These technologies that have emerged from cryptocurrency could be used in areas like cell phone tracking. Why does Verizon track everywhere I go? It's a side effect of how the cellular network works, that they need to know what cell towers I'm near. But there was a group of people who created a cell service that uses zero-knowledge proofs to blind the provider to the location and to the data that I'm flowing. Verizon could implement, if two guys could implement that, Verizon and AT&T and the others could implement that, but they don't want to. But more broadly in terms of payments, financial privacy is a mess right now. Jeffrey Fowler, who works for the Washington Post, went and bought a banana at Target and tried to trace exactly where that data went. And he found at least six parties that got a record of that purchase that he made. Target's payment of service, a point of service provider, the credit card, Visa, MasterCard network itself, the co-branded partner of the, anyway, all this stuff. And there basically is no way to engage in private transactions that don't have intermediaries, with the possible exception of cryptocurrency. And we need to fix our privacy, our financial privacy system. For us, our perspective is that privacy as a civil liberties issue, privacy is something that adheres in individuals. It does not adhere in companies or large organizations. If you're a company, you may want secrecy, and there may be reasons to provide, say, a funds manager who needs to prove they have assets without revealing what the assets are, or, to avoid revealing your trading strategies. But those are not privacy issues. Those are secrecy issues. And I have no expertise in what the right balance is in those kind of financial transactions, and the ACLU doesn't have that expertise in terms of like what's the right thing to make people reveal or not reveal.
Right.
When it comes to privacy, is something that adheres in individuals and really means saving people from being dominated by others by having their lives turned upside down.
So yeah, based AF. And some context too, prior to this, no one had even, confronted digital ID. There was a whole presentation on digital ID. Multiple times people talked about digital ID. In fact, he even responds to one of the other ladies on the panel who brought up this anecdote about a girl who wants privacy. And when she goes to give her license at a bar and she's young and pretty, she doesn't want the person behind the cash register to know where she lives because her address is on there. And he just takes a big dump on all the digital ID talk that had happened up until that night, bringing up really great points, right? Bringing up really good points, talking about how, if you were to go to that bar, they would want everything on your license and they can leverage that. And if you have all that information consolidated on your license, that's actually a bad thing. Right? Because over time, more and more places are just going to ask for your ID flat out. Like, just give me your ID. And it's going to be like a click of a button. So here's another really great clip from J.W. Verrett talking about the tyranny of the smart contract. Let's check it out.
Scale.
Okay.
But I think there's room for movement.
Okay. J.W., you wanted to say something?
Yeah. The presenters on the first panel are building some incredible products that are going to find great market fit in helping to make the AML compliance easier for central institutions, intermediaries that are required to comply. They'll find great fit with protocol builders who want to use them voluntarily for their own purposes. I fear the outer limits of what they could be used for. Can they lead to the sort of tyranny of the smart contract? You could find product market fit right now to try to help implement capital controls for countries around the world and stop crypto use as a way around these just human rights violations, I would say, in capital controls. You're an Argentinian and you lose 70% of your wages over a year in hyperinflationary environments, and you find stablecoins and Bitcoin as your last line of defense. Will the providers be willing to use digital ID to help implement capital controls? We could get to a lot of hypotheticals about purchase of guns, about abortion rights. Will they be willing to be service providers, see their programmable tools used for those purposes? We just coming out of Operation Choke Point 2.0, a very serious, I think, violation of rights, violation of economic rights, and it will be overwhelmingly tempting for a political party, left or right, to use programmable compliance, to use ZK IDs. I'm going to go on the record right now and say I predict there will be a Choke Point 3.0 eventually. And the tools used by the purveyors of that will be digital ID and programmable compliance, unfortunately. And that's what worries me. That's what worries me.
Steve.
Yeah, I mean, what a clip. And he's spot on, right? This, you know, concept of programmable smart contracts and stuff, it will eventually be used for nefarious reasons by people who are really powerful. And those people who are really powerful are going to be probably governments, right? They own the regulations that you're programming these things in. Well, why not turn it back onto the people? And yes, governments are absolutely going to be tempted by this power, right? You know, it's literally programmable money. That sounds terrible. If you look at it in that, you know, bad perspective, or that skeptical, cynical perspective, like I like to do on this show. So I think this is a fantastic point and something that wasn't brought up until this, at this point, right? That, you know, these, because over and over again, we've been hearing about how you can have these smart contracts and how they can be regulatorily compliant. Well, it's like, what if the people who are saying these regulations are the bad guys, right? It's like no one thought to, like, oh yeah, right. And so he's saying that here, and I think he's spot on. I mean, we talk about the Trump administration, they've been disappointing, but you know what, maybe they are better, you know, if they pardon Keone and whatnot. But it is something to say, though, that in America, you know, every 4 years, basically the party switches, and I don't think Democrats are going to be as nice. And if Democrats come in charge, you know, maybe they're going to be lax on certain issues, but on other issues they're going to be really hard on. And I think cryptocurrency is one they've shown in the past they're happy to be very, very hard on. And so that programmable, those programmable contracts that you've made in the past, well, now they can be flipped around and they can be used for bad. So here's another comment from Jay Stanley, where he talks about differential pricing. Let's give it a listen.
Hey, and then Linda.
I was just going to say, I mean, polls show that a lot of people are very concerned about their privacy, for example, online, but they feel as though they have no control over it, and so they live with that anxiety. And look, there's a lot of issues out there, from the environment to everything else, and it's a complex world, and people only have so much time to worry about so many things. But, I mean, the government's own statistics show that a significant proportion of the unbanked are so because they are concerned about privacy. And I think that even if people don't understand it, they will suffer effects if their privacy is invaded. For example, we're seeing a big discussion now on surveillance pricing, which is really where the rubber hits the road, where your data is directly used against you, against your own interests, by being manipulated through differential pricing. And so it's incumbent upon policymakers to protect people from that kind of manipulation and to help people protect their privacy. And I think the last point to make is just that I think that the arc of history is long, but it does bend towards privacy over time. People, eventually it sinks in, whether it's because of the pricing that they're getting is different from their neighbors or what have you. But like the telegraph companies were reading everybody's telegraphs in the 19th century for a couple decades after the telegram was apparently, some of the telegraph companies were trading on Wall Street based on inside information they got and everything. But a couple decades later, we put in privacy controls. It just took a while. And so I think that we will see a similar catch up in this world.
All right, we got one more clip here, and we're going to end with the best clip of the night. This was a Q&A question, which is a great question, by the way, and a great answer from J.W. Verrett. Let's give it a listen.
Hello. I'm just a developer, and I was curious. No one has talked about protections for developers. I believe code is free speech. Bernstein versus United States, Daily versus Younger established this on encryption in the 90s. However, even in the first administration, Virgil Griffith, a working member of the ETH Foundation, was charged under the Espionage Act, just speaking in North Korea, a public talk. During last administration, Roman Strom has been persecuted. Is there any protections for developers? Because if so, there's no incentive for any of this innovation to keep going, and it will continue to be offshored. And I believe it is a fundamental risk that, yes, we may be able to operate in this current administration, but there is no safety guarantees moving forward afterwards. And what is being done for that?
JW and Catherine.
Yeah, I support the sentiment. Last year at this time, this week before Christmas, I spent every day in prison with a defendant who mostly was charged because he used a privacy tool in U.S. versus Sterlingoff. And it was heartbreaking to go home to Christmas and just know that he was there. And he's looking at 12 years at this point. I am hopeful that we see some sort of something more concrete from this administration than the Blanche memo. It's a good start. But it is not much when we're still looking at Roman's going to prison. I mean, that's what we're looking at probably. And we're looking at Keone Rodriguez, who's a very principled cypherpunk-oriented guy, is going to prison for 5 years. I think that's an injustice, and I'm hopeful the administration still has a chance to remedy it at this point with a pardon.
So, yeah, there you have it. The roundtable actually ended up being fun. I was pretty surprised. And it was great too, because after this happened, I was like pumped up. I was like, okay, I got something cool to talk about tomorrow. And then the Keone Rodriguez news dropped. And it was like, wow. So it was a really nice, like, it was a nice couple hours after basically a previous 12 months of me just being pissed off. So that was nice. So I encourage you guys to check that out if you can. I don't know if they've uploaded it yet. But I will post a link in the description to a Twitter page. It was on CoinDesk, I think. They had a live stream of it. So I'll post a link to that. But now we got Super Chats. You can go to xmrchat.com/Xenu if you'd like to participate. And I got three this week. The first one is from Daedalus, who gives 0.02 XMR. Thank you, Daedalus. And he says, Xenu, welcome back from Spain. I binge listened to Watchmen Privacy after your recommendation. Top level stuff. Have you looked into Noster? We'd love to see you there. On there, us Monero bros are trying to take over the Bitcoin maxi culture. Yeah, so Watchmen Privacy, yeah, he's great. Definitely top level stuff. He really does his research. And his interviews are always very like intense. Like it's taking privacy very seriously. It's not just a gimmick for him. You know, he takes it seriously, and that's why I really respect the guy. It's actually kind of funny. I've been pronouncing Keone's name correctly this week because I listened to his podcast, and then I felt like an idiot because I've been saying Keon for the past 12 months that I've been talking about Samurai Wallet. But no, he's got a really good podcast with Keone. If you want a good summary of what went on with that, recommend you check that out. A lot of other good content as well. Now, you mentioned Noster. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of people bugging me about Noster. And so what I ended up doing is I made one. So I have a link now in my description for these videos. I got to put one on my website, I guess. I have a link also on my Twitter that I posted. So I'll try to remember to put my Noster on my contact page as well. But I did make one, so you can go and add me, follow me or whatever. I don't really like it that much, but you know what? I'm willing to try it out and try something new. So, you know, send me something that, you know, you like about Nostr or whatever. I'll check it out. We'll see what happens. I'm open to different things. I don't want to just stay on Twitter, obviously, because I do foresee that Twitter is going to be not as free in the future. I think they kind of let off some pressure in the last couple of years, but I think it's about to tighten up again. It's kind of how it works. You can never get too complacent, right? So I like to have an alternative to Twitter. I think this is a good idea, so I did it. And I am now a Nostr. Next up, we got a donation from ZKP2P, who gives 0.01 XMR. Thank you. And they say, ZKP2P is a trustless and privacy-preserving fiat to crypto on-ramp powered by ZK proofs. Okay, this is like an advertisement for something that I don't endorse for what it's worth. So, I mean, I'm going to stop reading there. Thanks for the donation, though, but it sounds kind of scammy. So I'll leave it at that. And lastly, we got a donation from Spurglord, who gives 0.01 XMR. Thank you, Spurglord. And he says, hey, Xenu, what are your favorite ways to get XMR without KYC? I like RetoSwap, so I'd recommend that. Bisc is RetoSwap, but with Bitcoin. Another, probably my favorite way, though, is through like donations like this. Through selling my merch. If you want to buy some merch, by the way, antimoonboy.com/merch. That tickles your fancy. And I like earning Monero and then spending it because that's totally without KYC. Mining is also a great way. In the past, local Monero was my go-to, but then after local Monero got shut down, yeah, I've pretty much just swept over to RioSwap. I am going to make this declaration, though. I'm going to have, like, at the end of 2025, I'm going to have, like, resolutions for Anti-Moonboy. And one of them is going to be just to have a little mini-series where I talk about how to onboard a Monero through different, applications. Like, I'm going to have a video for RioSwap, probably EigenWallet, you know, things like that. So I want to make, like, videos like that. I've just been freaking lazy, but I'm going to get around to it, all right? So maybe you'll be able to check that out, Spurglord. Well, guys, we're at the end of the episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. And we'll see you next week. A quick note, too. We are switching up the music at the ends of the episodes. We're going to be featuring 88 by Actress, one of my favorite electronic musicians. He dropped a bootleg mixtape a couple years ago, and it's absolutely fire. So we're going to be listening to tracks off that for the next couple weeks. So anyways, guys, hope you guys have a good week. I'll see you next Monday.